Hello, this is Mike Swanson. I'm the author of the book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In a few moments, another episode of The Great Parallax Views will begin. But before it starts, let me tell you about my book. It's available at Amazon.com, The War State. It's about how the United States became a global superpower after World War II and has brought us to this situation. Grab the book at Amazon.com after the show.
I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
So it's awfully convenient to me that, I don't know, 3 months before the election, everyone's thinking that Q is just this random guy named Jim Watkins and that it ultimately had nothing to do with Trump's people, even though Michael Flynn, a top general, gave an oath to QAnon on a video. So my thinking is that even if Jim Watkins is in control of this, which we already knew that he was, it doesn't change the fact that clearly Trump's people and his campaign are somehow involved in this. And, you know, there's no direct linkage to prove that they're posting or to prove that they're involved in the content of QAnon. But for some reason, they trust it enough to be promoting it on a regular basis.
Hey, Parallax Views listeners, on this edition of the program, the return of Robbie Martin from Media Roots Radio as he checks in with us to tell us about his new podcast series on the history of Freemasonry in America. Now, as I think most will know, Freemasons have been the target of conspiracy theorists for quite some time. But Robbie believes the true story is a little bit more interesting and a lot more nuanced. So we talk a little bit about Freemasonry and then transition into the subject of QAnon, which it turns out Robbie has been keeping a close eye on. And he believes the whole phenomena is an op of some sort, involving the Trump White House and, more controversially, in his opinion, potentially intelligence agencies. All that and more on this edition of Parallax Views with returning guest Robbie Martin of Media Roots Radio. Welcome back to Parallax Views. Last minute interview here, very impromptu, with Robbie Martin. How are you doing, Robbie?
I'm doing good. How you doing, man?
Pretty good. It's been a bit of a whirlwind of a weekend. I've had guests cancel on me because they had to cover the recent panic over Donald Trump getting COVID. So it has been a very, very long weekend, and that's why I needed to get you on. Because I'm having people cancel constantly and I needed someone to fill in, and I appreciate your doing that for me.
Oh, anytime, man. Yeah, I'm glad to help.
So it's
a win-win.
What has been going on with Media Roots Radio and your sort of commentary on current events lately? What were you doing before this whole Trump COVID thing happened?
I mean, I've been kind of off and, the China stuff, was really bothering me. When I say the China stuff, I mean like a lot of the anti-China rhetoric that has been building and building. We even saw like Judd Apatow, you know, talk about how the Chinese are running concentration camps now and things like that. So that was my primary focus. And then QAnon obviously was another one. And then I just sort of went into this rabbit hole on the Freemasonic history of the United States, because it's something that's been of interest to me for a while. And it's also something that feels, I guess, safer to fully go down the rabbit hole on, because it's historical. It's not attached to modern politics necessarily, even though in some ways it parallels a lot of aspects of it. So yeah, that's sort of where my head's been at recently. And I've probably gone too much down the Masonic rabbit hole. Cause now, like, when I look at the Gmail logo, I'm like, damn, that looks a lot like a Masonic apron. So I'm like,
well, I want to get into that. What's your take on the history of Freemasonry and its relationship to U.S. history? Because, you know, some people get into some wild territory with that. What's your take?
I mean, it's interesting because, like, you know, I've dabbled in and out of the conspiracy movement for like 20 years. So my initial interest in Freemasonry mostly came from like the conspiracy movement, kind of. I mean, technically that's not true because my Catholic friend who was in the same Catholic sect as Mel Gibson's father, the Society of St. Pius X, where they are pre-Vatican II, they wear head coverings in church. That's where my friend grew up in. The climate he grew up in. And for some reason, his priest of that church that he used to go to would do these sermons ranting about Freemasons. And he put in a cassette tape in my car. I had this old Volvo, like in my late teens. He threw the cassette tape in my car and I was like, why are you throwing in this like priest tape? I don't want to listen to this crap. Like I hate religion. I was like super atheist. Like I would have been like a new atheist back then, if you will. And my friend was like, no, you really want to hear this. And it was a guy, his priest ranting about how much of a travesty it is that, all of the founding fathers and historical American heroes are Freemasons, are secular, sacrilegious Freemasons, and how they need to be, you know, they should be replaced with good Catholic or Christian heroes and things like that. So that was like, honestly, my first introduction to what Freemasons were. And then, when I started to dabble in the conspiracy stuff, I was like, oh, they have, there's all this stuff about Freemasons being secret Satanists or being these, you know, people who control the government, that Freemasons are somehow like the idea of a quote unquote New World Order, you know, it's popularized by Alex Jones, that's somehow interchangeable with the Freemasonic, you know, control grid. And then over time, the Illuminati, you know, as you probably are aware, became the more hot conspiracy secret society group. And although there is some precedent for that too, like Robert Anton Wilson, you know, his Illuminati books sort of brought that back in the 70s. But now
there was actually a whole Illuminati panic in New England back in, I think, the 1800s. So these things pop up constantly. Yeah. Correction. The New England Illuminati panic, which I was trying to refer to, was in 1798, and it took New England by storm.
Yeah, so like that's sort of what got me initially interested in it. And, you know, and then I've also watched a lot of those documentaries where it kind of boils it down to, you know, the American Revolution was started by Freemasons and blah, blah, blah. And here's all these Freemasons who did these things. But I wanted to actually take like as deep as a dive as I possibly could and fully understand beyond the hyperbole, beyond the conspiracies, like what actual control Masons had and what I found out in my podcast series, which is almost more interesting to me than what kind of like control they had over governments. It was the idea that Freemasonry as an institution, as an occult practice, as this sort of culturally popular thing had an enormous impact on not just American culture, but also like our political landscape. I mean, the anti-Masonic movement that followed the death of this guy named William Morgan, who most people believe kidnapped and killed him because he revealed Masonic secrets, it spawned the first third political party in the United States and continued to shape the political landscape of this country for decades until the Civil War, really. And when you look at the time frame, I mean, that's a long period of time. That's, I want to say 40 years of American politics was largely dominated by this idea that Masons were evil and that the good people were in general anti-Mason. And it became sort of this populist leveraging tool where it became intertwined with populist movements against people like Andrew Jackson, for example. You know, today we're sort of misled by people like Alex Jones and even Trump who believe Andrew Jackson was this rebel, this anti-establishment president, when in fact, history shows that the populists at the time were very against him for being an elitist, for being a Freemason, for being basically like a rich real estate guy. And so that's like, it's sort of interesting to go back and just to see how much history gets rewritten over time. And now we're sort of, you know, we were led to believe Andrew Jackson was this rebellious kind of dude when in fact he really wasn't. I mean, he was really cut from the same cloth as the Washingtons or the Thomas Jeffersons, these sort of rich aristocrats. So there's a whole, I mean, I can explain a whole lot more, but that's sort of it in a nutshell of what I've been doing. And there's been three parts for this podcast series so far. And it's a really deep dive because it's 15 hours long so far, and it's going to continue to come in like four or five hour installments.
So I guess that leads to the big question. Is it true? Is Alex Jones right? Are all the Freemasons satanic worshippers of Jabulon?
No, I think it's more interesting than that in the sense that they practice a legitimate occult ritual. And there are Freemasonic practitioners who definitely believe in the power of that. And I think from a Christian perspective, anything that's occult seems satanic, generally speaking. I mean, I'm sure there are some smarter, more nuanced Christians out there, but
of course,
I mean, there's all different levels to it. But yeah, I mean, the whole Satanism angle didn't necessarily come into play until the late 1800s. So there was actually like several books written by people that made up a bunch of like lies about Freemasons and then also took certain quotes and passages out of context out of Albert Pike's writings. And Albert Pike is a curious...
The Scottish Rite.
Yeah, because he's probably arguably the most famous Freemason to have ever lived. And what he did was he rewrote all of the ascendant degrees beyond the third degree for the Scottish Rite. So all of the degrees beyond third degree, like the most popular form of Freemasonry, the Scottish Rite, all of those degrees are written by one guy who somehow had enough clout and knowledge about this esotericism to be able to write, you know, the fourth to the 33rd degree that they still use today. And he wrote a very famous book called Morals and Dogma. That's almost considered like the Masonic Bible, you know, even though there are technically Masonic Bibles and Masonic lodges that are just Masonic branded King James Bibles. This guy wrote basically what is considered the Bible for like their lore and their folklore and the esoteric meaning behind everything. Even though Masonry has been around, you know, 200 years before this guy, he sort of set it all into stone. And that's sort of the template in which they kind of come from now. And he praises Lucifer in his book and says a lot of interesting, weird things that, you know, to a evangelical Christian or any religious revivalist would just seem insane. You know, it would seem probably satanic.
Well, I hope people will listen to that series because I find the Masons interesting just because you mentioned that before the Civil War, there was a lot of anti-Masonic sentiment. And if you look back in history, there was anti-Catholic sentiment at the same time. And I sort of am very skeptical of the evangelical mindset because to me, the evangelical movement in this country seems to see anything that is not, you know, born again Christianity as basically being some form of devil worship. And I think we see that now with the topic you've covered of QAnon. I mean, it has a huge evangelical base to it.
Absolutely. And one thing I also found interesting, just coming back to the Masonry thing really quick, is that the anti-Masonic movement as we know it today is largely represented by historians as being hyperbolic evangelical Christian hysteria against Masons, when in fact that really wasn't the case. And I wonder why that's sort of been written into history that way, because if you really look at that 40-year span after the disappearance of William Morgan, the formation of the anti-Masonic party, then the folding in of the anti-Masonic party into the Whig party, and before the Civil War, there are a lot of very reasonable people who are like, yeah, this is really fucked up what happened. And Masonry is a problem. Like, it is a problem when 1/10 of the population are Freemasons that hold a secrecy oath, a loyalty pledge. And if you're if you're committed a crime and you're going to jail and the judge happens to be a Freemason, then you might get let off. Like, on a basic level, like that was a serious problem. Like, that's how popular Freemasonry was. It literally was 1/10 of the male population in that time period were Freemasons. And then later on, I think more of that evangelical panic came out. But very, very early on, the Catholics were the first ones to actually ban Freemasonry. They outright banned it. And they have an interesting history with Freemasons because the Knights Templars were sort of a group that, you know, the Freemasons claim lineage to now. And Catholics were, you know, the Knights Templars were sort of their sworn enemies. They separated from the Catholic Church. They were doing these rituals, these sexual rituals, even, you know, performing homosexual acts at the time. So it is, it's interesting. I mean, Catholics, I mean, I'm not giving Catholics a whole lot of credit here, but I generally see when Catholics react to something, even from like a papal declaration, as being more valid or interesting than like anytime evangelical satanic panic kicks in, because generally speaking, that's usually when you get to the really bottom of the barrel, you know, in terms of like what the public is outraged by.
I was going to mention too on the Freemason thing. I saw that you tweeted about John Brown, the abolitionist, and I did not know he was involved with the Freemasons. So I guess it is more complicated than, you know, oh, all Freemasons are part of an evil cabal.
Well, that's what's also fascinating is actually that the anti-Masons started to blame slave revolts on Freemasonry. Not because white Freemasons would help black slave escapes, a little more complicated than that. It was like French Freemasons might help blacks escape. Or even more crazy than that, there was already black Masonry in the early 1800s, Prince Hall Masonry, and they were allowed to have their own lodges and meetings. So, you know, at a certain point, people were like, well, if blacks in the United States know Masonic handshakes and know Masonic codes and know the idea of secret meetings and secret societies, and how do we know that like this hasn't infiltrated like slaves all over the country who are like trying to do uprisings basically using the tools of Freemasonry? So that became a concern. So it's really interesting how many different levels of society it impacted and how much it was talked about, and also how little the idea that America was founded on Freemasonry ever comes up during this hysteria. It's like that patriotism, the idea of America being this symbol, was still more important for people than to actually go back and be like, well, wait a second, America's founded on Masonic principles, so this whole thing is kind of weird. We should look at that. That actually didn't come out until maybe like the later or like early 1900s, late 1800s, that people started writing about how the Constitution itself was based on John Robinson's Constitutions of Freemasonry. Like there's actual passages they lifted straight off of it, you know? And that's sort of not seen as bad, even though it's just totally flies in the face of what we know about the founding fathers, that they founded this country and even did occult rituals to celebrate its founding. I mean, Washington is there doing a Freemasonic cornerstone ceremony, laying ceremony for the Capitol building. You know, he's not just standing there in a Masonic apron. He's actually using occult tools like symbolism for different things. He's pouring oil and wine and grain on the cornerstone for the Capitol building. And that is inherent in a Masonic ritual. It has all the symbolism. So to me, it's just like I tend not to take the conspiratorial angles or dig into those too much. I'm just more interested in actually like unpacking all this history about it, because it's just so rich and so much more nuanced than like any of the conspiracy narratives are about it.
I was going to say in that regard, I like digging into some of the fraternal organizations and secret societies as well. Stuff like the Bohemian Club or Skull and Bones, or even ones that people don't talk about, like the Boulay Society, which is sort of like the black secret society no one really talks about for some reason, unless you're involved with you know, various commentators in the black community. And what I find interesting is that
that link to the black Israelites, or is it totally unrelated?
No. It's a lot of members of like the black upper class are part of the Boulay Society, actually.
Okay.
It's a really interesting, it's a fraternal organization. But what I really find interesting about these organizations is that I'm not interested in, oh, they did some weird ritual at Bohemian Grove. To me, that's almost cover for the way in which these organizations act as networks of power. So, you know, if you belong to the big club, as George Carlin puts it, you know, you're in, and, you know, you're going to get preferential treatment. And sometimes I wonder if some of the more outlandish conspiracy theories are a way to get people not to look at the reality of how these members can get special treatment.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think I feel like I made a pretty strong case for showing that the Masons were even leaning into that in the 1800s after they basically, a lodge in Batavia, New York, kidnapped and killed a guy. It was like there was all this hysteria against them. But then at the same time, Masons were like, yeah, we did it. Like you reveal the secrets. I mean, it really deepens their mythos in a way to think that, you know, they had embedded in these rituals that if there's rituals that Masons do where you give blood oaths. You say, if I reveal the secrets, you recite these phrases that say that your bowels will be cut open, et cetera, if you reveal the secrets. But now they actually had a real version of that. Like, and it really did, I think, just increase their allure. And in a way, if you want to look at this as spiritual power, you know, even if you don't believe in any of the spiritualism, it energetically increased that, because now they have a real version of their own myth. This guy violated the secrets and he was killed. That's how serious our fraternity is.
Like stuff with Harima Biff?
Yeah, Harima Biff. Yeah, exactly right. So it almost goes beyond just a mafia form of intimidation. It's like a deeper spiritual form of it, I think, that sort of like really solidifies Masonry as this American occult institution. You know, that was their own American story that happened. Like no other Masonic lodge in the world really has a political upheaval that occurred from a local lodge. I mean, maybe P2 in Italy is the closest thing in the 70s. But other than that, I mean, this blows that out of the water, really, in terms of how much it shifted everything we know culturally in the United States. I mean, even arguably, even Mormonism might not exist if it wasn't for the death of William Morgan. People will have to listen to my podcast to understand why that is, but it's all connected in a weird way.
So I guess that leads us around to QAnon, because QAnon has become I'm just amazed at the fact that there's going to be people in Congress that are going to be QAnon candidates. And I keep telling people, I think this thing's an op. I don't know if it's an intelligence op or a GOP op, or, you know, it seems like it's something. Although now people are telling me, nah, it's just Jim Watkins. What's your take on QAnon and the whole Jim Watkins news?
I mean, I think actually an NBC news reporter kind of said it best. He was like, or no, he actually, now that I think about his analogy, I don't agree with it. Now I'm actually about to say it again. So squash that. But basically, I think that it's sort of interesting, because the whole time we've known that whoever's doing this QAnon thing, whoever's posting as it, has utilized the networks of 8chan and now 8kun. We've known that the whole time. That's not a secret. And we've already known that Jim Watkins runs 8chan. So to me, it's not a huge revelation that this guy, Jim Watkins, would have control over the information flow, because he does run the website. If Jim Watkins wanted to at any time, he could theoretically stop Q and end 8chan, right? So that to me is not anything new. What is new, the only new thing that I think was really important that was revealed, and I don't even know if Frederick Brennan, the other guy, revealed this, but that Jim Watkins actually became the recent domain owner of qmap.pub.
For my listeners that may be unfamiliar, who's Frederick Brennan, real quick?
Frederick Brennan is the co-founder of 8chan, and he defected, I guess, a couple of years ago, 3 years ago, and now he's acting as if he is sort of this heroic whistleblower who is going against the Trump movement, going against the alt-righters. But I mean, that's part of why I think that we can't necessarily trust his version of events, because he's got a conflict of interest. He doesn't want to be associated with these people that he used to be associated with now. That's clear. So I think it's a little sketchy that so many journalists right now are taking everything he's saying at face value. And it's also a little strange to me that, like you said, there are Congress people who are QAnoners. The president is dog whistling, not just dog whistling, but promoting Q at an alarming rate. I mean, it keeps going up and up exponentially. So it's awfully convenient to me that, I don't know, 3 months before the election, everyone's thinking that Q is just this random guy named Jim Watkins, and that it ultimately had nothing to do with Trump's people, even though Michael Flynn a top general gave an oath to QAnon on a video. So my thinking is that even if Jim Watkins is in control of this, which we already knew that he was, it doesn't change the fact that clearly Trump's people in his campaign are somehow involved in this. And, you know, there's no direct linkage to prove that they're posting or to prove that they're involved in the content of QAnon. But for some reason, they trust it enough to be promoting it on a regular basis.
I think the way I would put it is I always tell people I can't prove that QAnon is an op, but I can make a very strong circumstantial case for it.
Sure. Yes. And I think one strong circumstantial case you can make for the idea that Q is somehow an intelligence agency psyop of some kind is, you know, yes, it is riling a bunch of people up to commit potentially violent acts, to take up arms, to defend Trump, etc. But at the same time, like, the federal government is not Trump. And what I mean by that is I do think a lot of people are under this illusion that the federal government itself is like emboldening all these fascists, wants them to be roving around the streets. I don't think that's the case. I think at the end of all this, just like, you know, people are worried about Antifa getting quashed and like mass arrested and their guns taken away, I feel like the same thing's going to happen to these, you know, roving militias. I mean, why would the government feel comfortable with them, even if they're Trump supporters out there? I mean, those people are going to, I think, have a very rude awakening. So I think that that's part of why, you know, it's not just that they've gotten militia people to want martial law and to round up the left. Like, they've smoked out everybody. I mean, so in a sense, like, all these people are very easily surveilled now. You can track them, you can find out who they are, posting on social media more frequently than they used to. And that's what's strange to me, is these people don't have the long view of this, you know, that we could draw a historical parallel from the brown shirts and Hitler, that, you know, these strategy of tension, little armies, these militias, they eventually get quashed by the people that they're fighting for because they can't be controlled. So that's, you know, that's what makes me think this is just a long con psyop in a lot of ways. But then the other side of it that I think we really know that something's happening here is QAnon and a lot of these other things are leading to the censorship and the stifling of information flow on the internet. And that is ultimately, I think, the most dangerous thing that's going to happen here. I mean, yes, we could see some spasms of violence by QAnon supporters leading the election. Yes, Trump might waffle and say he's not going to leave. Those things are all scary. But the long view here, I think we should be thinking of is, do we want the internet to, do we want Twitter? Do we want all these social media companies to just be like, yeah, we're just going to ban everything QAnon? Well, QAnon is like, you know, this massive thing where there's tons of different conspiracy theories, real and fake, weaved into it.
I want to, you know, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I wanted to say real quick, there's this whole idea now arising where, you know, Q is coalescing into a grand unified thing where now the QAnon people are trying to get the UFO people involved, and you know, it sort of has infected every aspect of that conspiracy subculture, even parts that you wouldn't really think are related.
Yeah. I mean, let's just say 9/11 truth, for example. I mean, remember Marjorie Taylor Greene, the crazy QAnon candidate who was posing with an AK-47? I don't remember where she said it, but she's like, yeah, 9/11's an inside job. And it's like, God damn. Like, so now everything crazy is going to be associated with everything that's potentially valid. I mean, you know, and not that 9/11 truth was always, I mean, it always had crazy people that were sort of toxifying the mix, but it's like, now that you have QAnon people saying that, it's kind of really over. It's like everything, you know, is mixed together. If you say, I say the easiest one for people to understand, because if people reject trutherism, that's understandable. But the term of the deep state to me is the most interesting one, because now when you say deep state, a lot of people think you're a Trump supporter. And I had an argument with someone who, you know, they're posting this TikTok video of this woman saying, here's how you grade conspiracy theories. And she put MK Ultra in as the bottom ranking, meaning this theory is true and valid. Therefore, it's not necessarily a harmful conspiracy theory. She put deep state all the way at the top as being the most harmful and the most conspiratorial. And it's like, well, look, let's back up here for a second. First of all, 95% of the people online who talk about MK Ultra aren't talking about the real MK Ultra. They're talking about some weird, you know, like almost like a child sex trafficking reprogramming. Yeah,
they're talking about Project Monarch and Kathy O'Brien, which has no, there's no real evidence for that as far as I can tell.
They're talking about it based off of, there's all these like MK Ultra whistleblowers who came out who are essentially like crazy griftery people. Let's just be honest. Like years ago, and it's a real thing. MK Ultra is super real. It's crazy real, but so is the deep state. Even though we can't define it with faces and names, it's very, very real. The church committee essentially proved this. I mean, this is not something that can be disputed that this exists. So that's what's so harmful about all this. In the end, it's like even the concept of a deep state is now seen as laughable. And I even got an argument with someone who said, it's anti-Semitic dog whistling. And I'm like, really? We've already gone to that point where now saying the deep state is anti-Semitic dog whistling? I mean, come on. Like, we just can't allow all these terms to be absorbed, you know, into this watered down narrative, you know?
I was going to say in that regard, I mean, I do think a lot of the QAnon people are dog whistling. I do think there is like an anti-Semitism in how the QAnon types say it. But you know, I look at someone like, you know, my big influence, and I don't consider myself big into the truther movement or anything like that, but one of my biggest influences intellectually is Peter Gill Scott, who helped popularize the term deep state. And he's not some crazed anti-Semitic Trump supporter. So, you know, there is an issue here where everything is getting sort of crammed together. And, you know, oh, if you say this word, that means you're this. And it's not always true. There's a lot more nuance to it than that. And I think QAnon has done a lot of damage in that regard.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I believed Alex Jones was already causing a significant amount of damage before just by associating a lot of real things, deep politics subjects, I guess you could say, with crazy things. You know, he would bring up, like, Alex Jones was very good at cherry picking and lifting things from people like Peter Dale Scott and other sort of left-leaning, sort of imperialist academic critics, and then weaving them into this more crazy, hyperbolic, clickbait thing about how they're poisoning all the food and the water and the electronic waves are going to hurt us and all this stuff. And yeah, I mean, QAnon but has taken it to a completely whole other level. That's what makes me think that this is somehow, you know, it's driven. It's not just being that it's being promoted by the president, but it is somehow being driven by powerful entities. And by that, I guess my mind keeps going back to intelligence networks, agencies. I mean, you know, and I think it was Douglas Valentine who actually said that he thinks Mike Pompeo or other people put QAnon into operation. He thinks that he believes it's like fully a CIA operation.
I was going to say in that regard, it is interesting the people we see supporting this kind of thing now. I mean, it's people like you know, Anthony Schaefer was sort of going down the Pizzagate track of Anthony Schaefer of Abel Danger fame. Mike Schuer has gone completely QAnon and is calling for people to like violently resist the deep state, you know, by which he means anyone that's anti-Trump. And there's so many others. Steve Penchiak or whatever his name is, the Tom Clancy ghostwriter that used to work at the State Department in Italy during the days of lead. I mean, these are all people that sort of support QAnon or QAnon adjacent sort of things, like Pizzagate. And yeah, to me, that should be an alarm bell. Like, what's going on here? Why are these spook characters promoting this stuff?
Exactly, because they're experts in disinformation and information warfare, especially like someone like Pechenik and Michael Scheuer. So it really raises not just alarm bells, but a lot of questions. Like, are they part of it? First of all, are they, because they couldn't possibly endorse it. I mean, based on what it's saying, you know, they're smart people. They're not complete idiots. I mean, you would have, I do think you would have to be a lower level of intelligence than them to actually buy into it. So that's what makes me believe that there's some other game being played here. And, you know, to see Michael Scheuer saying that John Brennan deserves to be executed for Russiagate, I don't believe that for a second that he thinks that. I think that's, I think he's playing into some kind of illusion, you know, whether it's this idea that he wants to increase this idea that it's the deep state versus Trump or something else. I don't know, but man, I don't know. You know, when you have both Mike Scheuer saying that they believe in QAnon and Nora bin Laden, the niece of the person he was in charge of assassinating, says that she believes in QAnon too.
I knew she was a Trump supporter, but I did not know she came out saying that she's a QAnon person. Wow.
She is, dude. So that's when my brain really breaks, because I'm just like, I don't even know how to analyze this anymore. What do you do? What do you, you know?
So what do you make of how QAnon types are reacting to this news with Donald Trump? Because I've seen people saying, you know, oh, well, it's all fake. And then I've seen people say, well, if he did get some type of virus, it was the Chinese that put it on him. I've seen QAnon types say that. How do you think they're regrouping with the Donald Trump COVID news?
Well, I just discussed it with my sister, and it's pretty sad, actually, how Q, the poster, isn't giving anybody like the red meat they want right now. Q is actually really into kind of like generic electoral politics conspiracies right now, about the Dems and the election. And the QAnon supporters, like you said, have kind of gone off on their totally their own narrative. They think that Trump is actually not sick. Well, some of them, I've seen them say this, that he's not sick and that this is the storm coming. And that once again, it's cover for Hillary Clinton being arrested. And I even saw a QAnon person analyzing the tweet that he wrote saying, we're going to make it through this together. They broke down the word together and they were like, this is actually code for to get her. Hillary Clinton's going down tonight. And it's like, oh my God, I can't believe this shit. So that's what direction they're going on in. And, you know, Q honestly has gotten so lazy lately that Q's last post as of right now is a post linking to a Dave Rubin tweet complaining that Trump was asked to disavow white supremacy twice. That's how fucking boring Q is right now. I mean, that's like, to me, that really shows that Q has run out of ideas. If he's promoting a Dave Rubin tweet complaining about Trump disavowing white supremacy, I mean, Q supporters are probably bored. They want more. They want more like excitement. That's boring. So that's where I see Q right now, is it's kind of, it's not in that excitement zone that I think the supporters really want it to be. They're like kind of waiting, thinking like, what, like we need more than this right now. What's, you know,
my concern is that, like, you know, on the opposite end of QAnon, you have these sort of Democrats that, and I don't think anything on the Democratic side of things like Russiagate is as dangerous as QAnon. I think the QAnon types can, you know, potentially, you know, commit to violence, especially if Trump loses the election. But I'm really embarrassed when I see Democrats quoting things like the Palmer Report. I'm just like, why? Or what's her name? Louise Mensch. I just think to myself, or why are the Democrats now becoming, you know, completely bonkers in the way the QAnon people are?
Yeah, it's, I mean, there's definitely a you know, there's definitely a relationship between the two. I think that can't be denied. And I think that one of the clearest examples of that is QAnon would not be able to work nearly as well as it has without Russiagate, without the Russia hysteria, because it gives the appearance that there is some kind of deep state force trying to take down Trump. It feeds into that illusion. And I think that QAnon really sort of thrives off of that energy from Russiagate. Now, the other thing to be concerned about is that if you want to look at QAnon as a psyop, you know, let's say that the goal of QAnon is to censor the internet by making so many crazy conspiracy theories float to the top of all these social media networks, so they'll have, quote unquote, no choice but to censor it. Well, if that's the goal of QAnon, or one of the goals, then that's also, in on another level, what Russiagate has accomplished too. I mean, we really didn't start getting into this world of, you know, talking about censoring disinformation and, you know, foreign disinformation until Russiagate. So you can really see them as a sort of hand in glove psychological operation to create the necessity for a lot of people in this country to be like, yeah, we really do need to lock down the internet. The internet is too dangerous. Like, it's not just that these social media companies need to ban search terms or things like that. we need to like actually really lock down the internet because it's just gotten too dangerous. Like, and essentially that's a very smart way, I think, to sort of erode or distort our understanding of the First Amendment without actually removing it, because that's not the American way. I mean, it's going to be a long time before a fascist government takeover in this country will actually try to utterly gut the First Amendment. But this is a smart way to sort of quietly erode how we understand how the First Amendment plays out in this country, is by just stifling the internet so much so that in a way, in the end, it will be just as much controlled as something like the Chinese internet, for example, but we'll be doing it in a fair and democratic way where it won't be like, it won't appear that the hand of the government has come in to squash it. It'll appear reasonable. And that's, to me, what I'm most concerned about. And I think that's very much the direction that this is all sort of heading in, regardless of if it's the CIA doing it or whoever's doing it. That's the effect that it's having. And I'm very frightened to where that's going to take us. I mean, even Media Roots, for example, being on Patreon, you know, in my mind, I'm thinking that's not, might not last forever. You know, they might censor, they might be like, you can't have political podcasts on Patreon, you know, that talk about X, Y, or Z. So I don't know, you know, how close it's going to get, but I already feel like it's very close to, you know, for comfort.
I was going to say the thing that gets me is, you know, I think that a case can be made that Trump has ties to, you know, these sort of Eastern European criminal figures like Roman Abramovich and Semyon Mogilevich. I'm not sure that that has anything directly to do with Putin. But what gets me is people take stuff like that, those connections to these sort of oligarchic mob figures, and then they run with it, and we get stories like, oh, CIA sources say that, you know, Afghani rebels are being given bounties by the Russians. And, you know, now we have the NSA saying, well, we can't confirm that. The military said we can't confirm it. And everyone just acts like, you know, these stories are confirmed when they're not. And it actually makes resistance to Trump more difficult when we publish BS journalism.
Absolutely right. I mean, it is a really a shame. And I don't know why. You know, you would have to part of me wonders if that's part of the plan. I know that sounds really conspiratorial, but you do have to wonder, why are they deploying so many of these stories that just fall apart against him so often? It is sort of bizarre. Especially that bounty story, because just on its face, it doesn't make sense. It's like, if this was taking place during Trump, then it's been taking place the whole time. So to use this as some kind of assault against Trump specifically is silly. I mean, if Russians were doing bounties on Taliban, you know, American soldiers for the Taliban, why would they just start doing it now? You know, so that doesn't make sense. And also the Taliban doesn't need to get paid bounty money to kill American soldiers. They never have. I mean, so it just doesn't make sense on its face. And it is really surprising and weird to see it get all absorbed into that resistance network, you know, like Rob Reiner and all these celebrities, like this man, you know, he committed treason and he needs to be impeached just for this. And it's like, are you guys dumb? Do you not realize how many times that a story like this has come out that's fallen apart?
What's interesting to me is how, you know, there was just a news story that came out September 29th. It was in the Sun newspaper, and I think some other bigger newspapers have covered it as well. Trump orders Pentagon to review how quickly it can arm nukes ready for launch ahead of Russian arms treaty expiring. And Lawrence Wilkerson, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, was actually telling me about this. That's how I learned about it when I interviewed him last week. And you don't see anyone on the resistance side mentioning that he is sort of doing this in order to aggress Russia. But that doesn't fit the narrative that he's Putin's puppet, so no one's talking about it.
It doesn't at all. And in fact, those same people who are probably cynically calling him Putin's puppet want that aggression to take place and don't want it to become a story, because they know that if, you know, there'll be resistance against that if that gets too much media attention. So, I mean, I wonder, I do sort of sit back and wonder how many of these people in that quote unquote resistance movement, like in the Lincoln Project, all these ex-intelligence officials, how many of them really believe that narrative about Trump being a Putin puppet, or how many of them know that it's a cynical tool to use against them? And, you know, I don't, you know, I, in a lot of ways, Trump probably did some extremely shady shit in the election that they probably really want to pin him up against the wall for. And, you know, maybe it's a lot of different stuff, but this Russia thing to them seems like it's the best weapon to use. And they just, you know, they know that it's not necessarily true, but they still keep using it. I mean, sometimes I really do wonder if that's the case, because, you know, after the Mueller report and what we saw in there, it's like, they're really, if you can't directly link these things together, then you really kind of just do need to put it aside, because how long could they keep pumping that? I mean, how much longer? It's there's just not much steam left in it.
Well, it's also like I mentioned Mogilevich and those sort of figures. You never hear them talk about that. You never hear them talk like about a mob figure like Semyon Mogilevich, when really like his connections to Trump are probably much more concerning than most of what came out of Russiagate.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not personally familiar with Trump's connections to them. I believe you on that. I feel the same way about, you know, Trump's connection to Israeli government people and Sheldon Adelson and those kind of people, you know. But then that opens up a whole other can of worms. It's like, why do we only hear about Russian bots, Russia, you know, Iranian bots, Venezuelan disinformation networks online, but we never hear about Israeli bots, Israeli disinformation networks. We never hear about American disinformation networks propagandizing us. We never hear about corporate disinformation or bot networks online that are sock puppeting to try to promote a particular agenda. It just always comes down to the adversaries of the United States that are.
Are you familiar with, there's this private Israeli intelligence firm called Psy Group, which they're mentioned multiple times in the recent Senate report on the Russiagate stuff, but no one's covering it in the news.
Oh, I'm so glad you brought that up. Okay. What's really fascinating about that revelation from that report, this is also in the Mueller report briefly, but it didn't get as much coverage, I don't think. And what's really crazy is an Israeli official is actually telling Roger Stone that they have an October surprise coming up that's going to help Trump. And like, that's exactly what the Russiagate defenders have been saying that Julian Assange did to Russia, to Roger Stone. They're trying to say that that Julian Assange personally told Roger Stone exactly when these leaks were going to come out and what was generally in them. Now, I don't know. I mean, sounds an awful lot like someone in the Israeli government knew Pizzagate and knew the Podesta emails and some other things were going to drop based on that statement. And that's a direct quote. He says, there's an October surprise that's going to help Trump, like, win this election. Pretty bizarre that that got zero media attention. Zero. I mean, I think it was written up in the Israeli Times, or like the Israel Times. That was the only place I read it. So, yeah, that really fascinates me. I mean, how much meddling the Israeli government could possibly be doing, you know? I mean, I don't know. I mean, that's total speculation, but you do have to wonder, why is all this energy being poured into Russia? But then on the other hand, you know, I get bothered too. It's like, you know, there is something having to do with the relationship between Russia and Trump that is sort of odd, in the sense that why is Russia today, for example, just like a pro-Trump mouthpiece now? Like, why would the Russian government spend money on this TV network to just blast out pro-Trump, like, partisan crap? Like, that sort of just is confusing to me. I don't get that. But, you know, none of the resistance people are talking about that. To me, that's a more interesting indicator that there is some weird relationship between them that people don't really fully understand. So, but maybe I'm reading into that too much. I mean,
well, I think the other thing is, like, when you talk about this stuff, like when you talk about Psy Group, you know, immediately people think you're creating like some giant conspiracy where, you know, oh, the Jewish cabal runs the world. You believe in the Protocols of Zion. And that's not what I'm saying at all. You know, and it's just anything. When you discuss any of these topics, whether it's Russia or Israel or any other country and their relationship to the U.S., it becomes, oh, you think everyone in Russia is bad, or you think everyone in Israel is bad, or you think, and it's not really that. I'm just trying to put together the pieces without being sensationalistic about it.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's that's another problem, going back to what we discussed with QAnon, is why these sort of massive clickbait, you know, conspiracy movements are harmful, because they create this appearance from more reasonable people who are conspiracy resistant to see, you know, if you bring up Cygroup and the fact that it's a private Israeli intelligence thing, you know, the part of their brain will be like, that sounds like it could be potentially part of that, you know, anti-Semitic conspiracy stuff we've been hearing about on the news, you know. And that's the unfortunate part about it, is you, that's why I think doing any, I mean, it's just, there's really no way around it other than just not playing into the more clickbaity nature of this stuff and just like actually doing it in a, in an ethical journalistic way, you know, like a real journalist. So, you know, there's just no way to avoid that. And you know, it's like, I'm trying to think of another example of what you just said. I mean, Soros is a good one, but I mean, the right does like cartoonishly fixate on Soros. It's like their only oligarch besides Jeff Bezos that they think is evil. So it's just, you know, it's silly, but again, there is weird stuff about George Soros, and Soros is a weird character, and you know, he does spend, throw a lot of his money around, and that's not anti-Semitic to talk about the fact that he's a weird dude that needs to be like called out.
I was going to say real quickly, my dad recently picked up a magazine. It's called Range Magazine, which is apparently a magazine about the Wild West. And for some reason, they're now publishing anti-Soros articles, calling him Soros, the destroyer of worlds. And my dad said, you know, if this guy is trying to take over the world, he's like, what, 89 now? He better pick up the pace a little bit. it makes the conspiracy theory. I mean, that's why some of the conspiracies about Soros always fall flat for me. I'm like, if he's the only one trying to take over the world, he's doing a mighty poor job of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's just so funny, you know. Tucker Carlson is looked at as this populist and these right populists, and like, they don't talk about oligarchy, they don't talk about billionaires, they talk about individual, like almost like in 1984, it's like your 5 minutes of hate. It's just like, it is sort of a populist leveraging tool. It means nothing to yell at Jeff Bezos on your Tucker Carlson segment for 5 minutes, you know.
Well, it's a repeat. Go on. I'm sorry.
So you're not doing a structural critique that actually provides any deepness or depth to what is happening. It's just catharsis. And it's, you know, these Republicans who buy into that, it's just kind of sad and pathetic to me, because like, don't you see that you're just being manipulated and just shown, here's this oligarch for you to yell out on today's segment. And here's the same one we showed you last week. It's Bezos again, or it's Soros again, or it's the mayor of this Democratic city. You know, it's like every fucking time it's the same shit they pull out. And these people keep falling for it. And it's sad. To me, it's just ultimately sad, because they know something's wrong. I'll give them credit on this. They know something's wrong on a deep gut level, but they're letting their rage be channeled into just useful idiots for like a partisan engine. When in reality, you know, maybe something could snap these people out of it, and they could see that the system itself is fucked, and it's bipartisan. You know, it's bipartisan. It's capitalism is also a problem. But that's what I got. I don't know. I just totally went off on a rant. I know you don't have much.
I was going to say before we close out, it's interesting you mentioned the Tucker Carlson stuff, and oh, he's a populist. But you know, the thing is, this is all stuff that we've seen before. You know, I've heard people say, oh, the John Birch Society was like the proto-populist movement for right-wingers. And you know, I say to people, it was never populist. It was founded by Texas oil men like H.L. Hunt. And it just, we keep seeing this repeated over and over, where right wingers take the idea of populism, and it's sort of a faux populism hoisted up by the extremely wealthy, including Carlson himself. I think he's from a real well off family.
Oh yeah, Swanson dinner fortune. What's great is whenever I think about his family, I think of that line in No Country for Old Men when Chigurh is at the gas station and he's like, "So you married into it." To the guy at the counter as like an insult, because that's a fucking Tucker Carlson's dad, like they married into Swanson dinner fortune. Tucker Carlson's dad was like some like low level reporter until he actually got picked to be the head of the CIA's media arm, Voice of America. But yeah, it's so funny, man. I mean, like it's like Tucker Carlson presenting himself as a man of the people, Trump presenting himself as a man of the people, and then their side trying to like bash Bernie for being like owning like $1 million in property or something. It's like, come the fuck on. Like, you guys, I mean, it's a game. Politics is a dirty, dishonest game. And I mean, that's, I guess it's not a, I'm not making, you know, anything more than a very obvious point that it's like the level we're at now, nothing, the truth doesn't matter anymore, man. It's just what hits the reptile brain the best and gets people the most riled up.
That, you know? That was the one most brilliant move that Trump made at the debate, was when he said, oh, you're supported by the socialists, Biden. And Biden said, I beat the socialists. I beat Bernie Sanders. And then Trump said something that no one has talked about. He said, well, you've just lost the left then, haven't you? And Biden didn't respond. Yeah. I mean, it is a brilliant move. People haven't mentioned that.
No, I thought that, I mean, that's Trump is a smart dude. He understands, he understands politics very well on a gut level. I mean, and even though he didn't even seem that well coached during the debate, yeah, he's still got it. I don't know if he gained anything from the debate, but I mean, he's still got whatever that fire and that, you know, that skill that he has, it's still there for sure.
So, Robbie, how can my listeners keep up with your work and Media Roots Radio?
Well, we do Media Roots Radio 4 times a month. You can subscribe on any of the podcast services. I hate plugging corporations' names, but you know, like iTunes, those kind of services. If you become a Patreon subscriber of ours, for $5 a month, you get access to the fourth episode is a bonus episode for subscribers only, and that's where we're putting the Masonic History series right now. And you can find that at patreon.com/MediaRootsRadio. And you can follow me on Twitter at Fluorescent Gray.
Well, I am glad you're able to come on the show, and I want to thank you again, Robbie, for coming on Parallax Views.
Thank you so much, man.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Robbie Martin of Media Roots Radio. Please be sure to check out his work and the work of his sister, Abby Martin, who I'm hoping at some point we can get on this program. Shout out to her. I know she recently had a baby. So congratulations, Abby Martin. And congratulations, Robbie Martin, on becoming an uncle. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at ParallaxViewsPod@ProtonMail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Amelia, Mark, Martin, Brace, John, Ted, Zach, Gratz, and Mickey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, join the $10 or $15 tier at my Patreon at patreon.com/ParallaxViews. That's patreon.com/ParallaxViews. And with that being said,
until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety, problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.